Most New Zealanders know who Christine Fernyhough is. Her first husband, John, was the architect of our state-owned enterprises and the chairman of Electricorp. She set up the Gifted Kids program for high-achieving children in low-decile schools, co-founded Books and Homes with Alan Duff, and then came the Limited Service Volunteer program run by the Defence Force. She's been a leading Auckland philanthropist, but in 2003 she left Auckland altogether for a complete change of life on Castle Hill Station near Porter Heights. She made a good go of that despite the usual market fluctuations, which can make high country farming an uncertain enterprise. In 2007 came the bestseller, The Road to Castle Hill, a high country love story, and then Ben and Mark, Boys of the High Country, and some picture books for children. In 2015, she announced a new venture, the Museum of the Everyday, a collection of New Zealand craft, design, folk art, and social history. It's probably the biggest collection of its kind outside Te Papa. And now there's a book to go with that, Mid-Century Living, the Butterfly House Collection, with everything in it except the kitchen sink, domestically from days gone by. From furniture to toys and games, tableware to ornamental objects, royal family memorability to Kiwiana, from crown linen to hand-coloured scenic posters. I'm reading from the publisher's blurb now because it's an efficient sort of description. These objects are a nostalgic, colourful and tangible record of the way we lived and the things we surrounded ourselves with. Christine Fernyhough, hello.
Hi, how are you, Joe?
Very well, thank you. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Your book is carpeted. There's the floral carpet from the batch represented on the inside covers. That's a bit unusual for a start.
Well, it certainly is, but it is fantastic. It was the days when woolen carpets, patterned woolen carpets, were all the rage. It's called Floral Bouquet, and it's been down since 1995, 96. It has had parties, it's had salt, it's had sand, it's had babies, it's had drinks, it's had cups of tea and coffee, it's had everything spilt on it. And apart from a little bit of threadbare on the north face, sunny French doors, it's still perfect.
Yeah, it looks in good nick.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a good advertisement. Days gone by, and before we get to everything in your book, those days are from a New Zealand that's disappeared now. Don't you think, in many ways, because you yourself lament in the book that we don't make things the way we used to.
No, I don't think we do, though I have been travelling round and people are quite quick in saying, well, I've taken up macrame again, or I've taken up embroidery and my husband's doing some work with wood. But in the main, we haven't. This was a time where the handmade and the homemade and the interior decorating of people's homes were very important to them. If we take post-war, the government gave some loans so people could buy houses. And for the first time, there was a bit of discretionary spending. So there was the stove and the fridge and the furniture. But to supplement up and to make their houses individual, women who were still mostly the homemakers at the time just did wonderful things, whether it was poker work, whether it was embroidery, whether it was macrame, whether it was working with shells or flax or wood. They were just wonderful, and so too were the chaps, and so too were the kids at school with woodwork classes. And
austerity generates creativity in a way.
Well, given spare time, I mean, no TV, 6 o'clock closing,
yes.
No shopping, just the joy of making things. And Women's Weekly and Aunt Daisy's were hugely influential in encouraging new designs and new things coming from overseas.
So. Actually, Aunt Daisy's in your book, and yeah. You talk up a recipe of hers for oxtail stew.
Yes, I do.
What makes it so good, her recipe?
I don't know, I just like it. But I remember, and I do write in the book, my Auntie Gwen, because my Auntie Gwen was a huge Aunt Daisy supporter. Also, she was a Dr. Paul listener, and she was a Portia Faces Life listener, which is the one I liked. It was a sort of, I don't know, just a story about life. And she was a woman who ever dared to love completely.
That's right, Portia. That's in the book too. Portia, I don't know how it got into the book, was a woman who dared to love completely. Life with Dexter was my appointed listening at, I think, 7 o'clock on a Tuesday night. Those were the days when, as you say, radio was the main entertainment. And we used to live differently in lots of ways, because your humble fibro-lite batch at Mangawhai Heads is also a legacy of the time when batches were never mansions by the water, were they?
No, they were
batches.
Not. They were not. They were small little structures because fibrolite was way cheaper to build in than wood. In our case at Mangawhai Heads, some of the little batches were dotted amongst the bracken and the sand and the reeds were little batches put up by farmers who were farming inland. And they built these lovely little one-room places with a loo outside and a bit of a kitchen. But they, in Christmas, they really couldn't enjoy it because they were always haymaking. So they'd have to do it in the other holidays.
Or fixing up the batch.
Yeah, fixing up the batch.
And you say early on that here is not just history as a kind of dull, generic word. Here are people's lives and passions and their identities. And I can imagine them saying goodbye to some of these objects that you have in this book with a lot of regret sometimes.
Well, yes and no. When we hit Mangawhai Heads in 1995, everybody was starting to discover. It's only about an hour and a half from Auckland, and people were discovering. But what is typical is out with the old and in with the new. So there was a huge rash of garage sales. And a lot of the articles and objects and pieces that I got at the beach, we picked up in those times, whether it be a 3-in-1 Thorn radiogram or whether it be those gorgeous glasses with the balls all over them that used to have the cheese spread. Just so many articles we've bought there. And gnomes out in the garden.
Yeah. Isn't it also funny how we insouciantly discard objects that we think are mundane, but later on they acquire, as you have discovered, a luster, don't they?
Well, they do because they're rare. They're individual, they're one-off. I've got, alongside my butterfly collection, I've got a thing called, and you're able to do it in New Zealand, they're so encouraging if you want to make a collection. I've got a collection called the Museum of the Everyday. It's got like 3,000 pieces. You can access it on eHive. And even the most humble thing, once it's measured, taken a photo of, given a description, given a date, given a space, it's really wonderful. They just become like great pieces.
Mid-century living, the Butterfly House collection. Christine Ferniehoe is with us. The Butterfly House of the title. Why Butterfly House originally, please?
Because, two things probably. One is because this fibrolite batch had this sloped back roof and it was poised on the edge of the Mangawhai estuary and it just looked like it was taking flight. And also my father was an absolute lover of monarch butterflies. He would watch their flight. He would feed them cabbage if anything happened to the swan plant. And so even now when butterflies, the monarch butterfly comes past or nestles close to us, we think it's Gramps making sure we're all okay.
I didn't know they ate cabbage. I knew about pumpkin.
When they're hungry, they eat anything, I think.
And you've got a butterfly mirror, which is striking.
Yes, it is.
And a ceramic butterfly vase from the Titian studio 60 years ago.
Yes.
What happened to that studio?
It was taken over, really, by Crown Lynn.
Right.
It started as Sherwood Studios in Waitakere's and came back down to New Lynn. And it never competed with Crown Lynn for tableware. I've got that footy boot where Waikato beat the Springboks in 1956. And it's number 9 boot. It was Don Clark's boot. And it's got the right coloured socks on either side. And it's a Toby jug. And it's extremely ugly, but it's extremely rare.
When you began to furnish this batch, you know, through garage sale expeditions and everywhere you went. Were you setting out to do something?
I was setting out to interior decorate it in the time. And I didn't have china cabinets, which were very much the time to put your treasures in. But we had lots and lots of shelves. And I didn't really care. I just wanted things for the 50s and 60s. So I might have a bit of Murano glass or I might have a Barsony black base from Australia. But as I started collecting and as I started filling up the batch, I got more and more passionate about learning more and researching more. And this is where I did my focus from the eclectic to the eclectic, but to the New Zealand made.
The batch has stayed a batch despite being crammed with all manner of objects.
Yes.
You can sleep and eat in it.
Yes, you can. I know it looks like a museum, and I've got certain members of my family that thinks it's clutter, which it might well be. You can brush your shins, but there's always delight. You walk in, and one of the wonderful things about that period is that all the walls are bright. They're turquoise, or they're yellow, or they're red, or they're orange. And so people who walk into the Butterfly House for the first time, they can't stop smiling. And we live in it. It's totally lived in. It's not preserved. It's not don't touch. It's just wonderful. And it makes you happy.
There's a surprising amount of emotion in this book, which I should have expected because you're a writer. But somehow I thought it would just be a well-written account of collecting and pleasant summers by the beach. But here, in here is your last summer with John Fernyhough and your last conversations with him about deep things, your dad dying in your arms, that tumultuous period after which you decided to go south to Castle Hill. So here are actually bedrock moments of life, you know, surrounded by that sunshine and craft and frippery. Mm. It's an interesting contrast.
Yes, it is. I think I was very lucky with John. We had this quite big boat, and so we did a lot of yachting and then boating. But I really wanted a place on land, and I wanted it an hour from Auckland. We were starting to get our grandchildren. Will was the first one born at the time. And I wanted a marae. I wanted that sense of belonging, the dimensions of belonging, you know, the memories of belonging. And so that's what encouraged us to find a place, which we did at Mangawai. And I didn't know also, because John's cancer was progressive and we didn't know how long he'd be able to steer his ship. And even though he was reluctant to be a landlubber, he did love being at the Butterfly House. He became involved in the local politics, trying to stop curbing and channeling. And he did lots of planting out on the estuary part, which the hurricane had broken and breached. He really loved it, and we had it last summer there.
It's beautifully positioned from the look of it. That estuary is a fantastic one at Mangawai, and then there's the marvellous surf beach. And it seems to have views of both, yeah?
It does. And I agree with you, because I always used to think when people were talking about estuaries, they were talking about Australian mangroves and having to walk for 2 kilometres to get a swim and then only up to your knees. But where the estuary is below us, it's over your head at every tide and any tide. And it's got lovely things like funny boats at anchor or on moorings, actually, and they turn and twist with full tide, part tide, you know, half tide. They're like a windsock on the water, really. And beautiful birds. Every time the tide goes out, all the birds start chatting, you know, as the cockles and the pippies and the, you know, snapper biscuits and everything become available to them. Great, great number of birds. It's a beautiful, beautiful location for that.
It's got flounder in it too, that estuary. Our children tried to catch them.
Not with success, I must admit. Right. And then John nearly took my foot out when we were trying another night without strong enough light.
Now, you have quite controversial material in the batch too.
Yep.
And you've got black African silhouettes on the walls. How did New Zealanders manage to acquire so many of these? They were ubiquitous.
They were just on Californian walls. They were internationally, you know, they were just overseas. And I don't know actually who imported them. John Crichton might have. And people bought them and put them on the wall because they were seen as exotic.
Yeah.
I never thought of it being there as being offensive to our Māori. I just thought, you know, it was just an interior decoration of the 50s and 60s.
I'm sure a lot of people thought the same thing. And the ceramic Jim Beam bourbon bottles in the likenesses of Honeheke, Hongihika and Taropraha, which, as you say in the book, would have been offensive even in the 1970s, brought out by the New Zealand Sports Foundation.
Most extraordinary.
What were they thinking?
I would have no idea. And it was very offensive because here were these leaders of Māoridom full with alcohol and then singing songs if you lift them up.
Right.
You know, they're like singing Jim Beam bottles.
And I suppose the question is, would they have brought out Jim Beam bottles in the likenesses of Captain Cook and Ed Hillary? I don't know if they ever did.
I don't think they did.
No. You make the point that as tasteless as this was, they went to a lot of trouble to get their detail right in the depiction of these men as whiskey bottles. They weren't crude caricatures. So you have this dichotomy of respect and disrespect at the same time.
Yes.
It's weird.
Yeah.
And the swirly girly swizzle sticks.
They're terrible.
That people use to stir their drinks. And bare-breasted, dark-skinned women. And there were tons of those on New Zealand lamp bases, weren't there? Your defence of showing items like these is that they also show attitudes we have moved a million miles away from.
We have. They're extraordinary. I mean, they're extraordinary that they'd actually... One, I suppose that I bought them, but they were about in circulation. And I suppose I bought them because they were intriguingly bad taste. I've got one other little piece which is in the book, which is the most extraordinary thing. The English potteries had catalogues, which they sent round the entire empire. And there's one of a little black boy sitting in a bed. And the coverlet of the bed is clear until someone buys it. And in my case, it's Te Puke. And it's got the main street. It's the main street of Te Puke on a coverlet, on a bed, with a little black boy sitting up one end with his hands up in the air. And there's a bug on the side of the bed, and it's a study in black and fright. Black and fright. I mean, it was Te Puke here. It could have been New Plymouth. It could have been Hawera. It could have been any other place, or it could be somewhere in South Africa or Australia or Canada. They were just part of the catalogue going out from Stoke-on-Trent.
Yeah, they were. I noticed that figures and figurines, clearly meant to be European, like a classical dancer, and you've got one of those, could be black as well. So black was regarded, I wonder, in some ways, as well as the unconscious racism, as a preferred colour in a way.
I think it was exotic and daring and beautiful. Yeah. I think probably beautiful.
It's interesting how the male gaze has stayed constant in advertising. It's just become more subtle. You have a naked woman breaking out of a shell and advertising Pi TV sets.
Yes, we have.
It's amazing. Well,
and Pi TV sets. See, if you take that period where all, like Crownland and the glass makers and the plastic makers and the clothing makers were all protected by high things when you came into New Zealand, Pi was one that I thought Mr. Waller had made it all in the back streets of wherever he was making pie. But actually they were assembling them because the tax was so high coming in as fully made up. Yeah. They bought them in bits and they just put them together. He wasn't actually an electronic whiz.
That shatters a myth, though, because we all assumed he was.
And there's a lot behind most doors in the bathrooms, there is calendars of that period. And they were unashamedly mean to women and very obvious to their body and all sorts of angles and positions.
Let's get to the purely splendid and interesting, though. The marvellous glassware and pottery. An exquisite bellows for the fire with a tui on it. Mm. You have to see this, really, but an amazing Crownland Three Faces of Eve lamp.
Yep.
And you can tell us some of the provenance of what's in the photos from the book. But the point of your collecting, it has not been just seeing things you like and taking them back to the batch. It has been researching where all the craft came from.
Yes.
You made a rod for your back there, though, gee.
I sure did. And I'm also a bit sceptical. I'm a bit sensitive because I hope I've given everybody due value and correct in my dating and my reasons why I've described them such. They're just the most extraordinary period. Objects talk to you. They'll talk to anybody to listen. They tell stories. They tell stories of a time, a space, where we lived, where we were. And the early people from England who came here, they were trying to get away from rosebuds and thatched cottages. So they adopted flax and power and clays, and they made a whole range of useful and articles that were not only useful but were decorative or purely decorative articles to tie themselves back to their new land. And this is where they did, which we now see as very offensive, the appropriation of Maori imagery. But it was very intriguing and very splendid. And some would argue that the enduring nature of the embellishments of the pieces enable people to understand and to become much more aware of the folklore or the legends of Māori.
And there was a desire for Tūranga Waiwai in it, wasn't there? They wanted their own co-opted, merged place to stand.
And also Crown Lynn, when they saw how well Royal Dalton and Winton was doing with their Māori imagery and their plates and their mugs and their use of tiki and wharanui, they produced a wharatāna of souvenirware, heavy as anything, made of solid jolly clay, highly brown glazed, pale green inside, meant to look like pōnamo. And they were unashamedly said it was to do with Māori. It was all to do with Māori imagery and Māori folklore.
Is the good Crown Lynn like our Royal Dalton in a way now?
Yes. The hand potted by Ernest Shufflebottom is still collected and paid well for. The swans, the original swans, you must be careful because there's been reuses of the various designs, but you've got to get the original. The pieces of tea sets made with Dorothy Thorpe with her golf ball handle. And really the one I like the best is Frank Carpe. And he was a friend of Picasso, and he came and did these most wonderful avant-garde Picasso-esque pieces. But Tom Clark, with all his wonder of advertising, he couldn't sell them. No, and he said he was the saddest when he had to ask Frank to go down the road because they tried desperately to get his pieces, and now they're sort of like the McCann of the
To fathom looking back. Dorothy Thorpe was a big-name designer, wasn't she?
She sure was in California. He thought she was a grumpy aunt when she turned up because she swept in for a sort of a few days and she berated them for just shoving their back stamp on any angle on the bottom of their wares, and they dissented because that was what precision was about.
Let's whiz through a few things and include some history. The Amber Tips tea leaf strainer, the tea caddies themselves, you've got the tea cosies too. Do people have tea cosies anymore?
I do, but then I quite like them because, I don't know, they just stew up the tea more. No, these are the things that are interesting because tea bags, a lot of people have tea bags, a lot of people don't brew up tea from leaf. I've got a whole array of things which are pretty outdated, like pepper and salt shakers.
Yeah. Christine Ferniehoe's with us, mid-century living, the Butterfly House Collection. I wonder if anyone's listening to us this morning on a Bell Cult radio. Actually, they were popular.
No, fabulous. Fabulous colours.
Yeah.
This one's turquoise, but there's yellow and grey, and they're fabulous. It makes a terrible squeak. I can't get it to go.
Tea towels, still in vogue.
Yes.
Placemats, not so much now.
I use them because we up there we've got Formica, and Formica's not terribly good on with hot plates on it. So I do use them.
Hillary's Honey.
Yeah, I've got a carton of Hillary's Honey.
That was a brand.
Yes. It was his.
It was his.
Yes.
Made by Sir Ed.
Well, made by his father himself.
Right,
I think he was pushed into action there at the aperies, apparently.
Oh, wasn't somebody stealing the name?
No. It's a beautiful old... Do you remember when we used to buy it in wax cardboard? It's waxed cardboard on the outside, which is so much better than plastic. I mean, I'm hoping listeners will be saving the single-use plastic bags with whatever font is used to advertise New World or whatever else, because they will be the things someone like me will be collecting 40 and 50 years out.
Well, it's interesting because you note that we've gone full circle from paper bags, which used to be used all the time, and you've got some of those in your book, to plastic bags, and now we're going back to paper.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know I'm whizzing through now, but I do want to mention as many things as I can. Your bone china pink flamingos standing on a bed of reeds. And at first I thought kitsch. And then I looked closely, and there is a point where kitsch becomes an unfair word because of the sheer skill and the design.
Yes, yes. That was a Burlington Bertie buy. And they're really lovely. They're sort of tall and willowy, and they've got all those pinks and funny off green colours. And they fitted well. And that was an example of me buying, you know, an English piece before I focused on the New Zealand.
I can imagine you rummaging high and low to find all these objects.
Oh, you've got to. You've got to be a scanner in a shop.
Yeah.
And now I never, ever buy anything online. I have nothing of these collections or online purchases.
Why? Just because you...
I just don't know. I like to touch them and to feel them.
Okay.
I've made mistakes when I've even touched them or looked at them or seen them. Everybody's very minimalistic these days, so they don't want all these, you know, they're deceased estates where children don't want them, grandchildren don't want them. And it's really hard because when you think about it, at the time we were collecting and having china cabinets and mantelpieces, we had quarter acre sections in a home.
Yeah.
If you can't buy a house, which is difficult for so many people, why buy stuff to go in it?
Yeah, good point. You say that the old Sunlight soap shakers are as scarce these days as hen's teeth. Mm. They used to be ubiquitous too. You'd
they
see them in
everywhere.
Every sink.
Every sink, we had one everywhere. I mean, we had one at our city house and at the beach place in Stanmore, which I talk about.
And just to explain, the soap was trapped
in
a shaker device.
Well, it's sort of like wire,
and
it was like a bed of crisscross wire, and used to cut because Sunlight soap came in long strips, so you had to cut it, or Tanifa. But most people use Lever Brothers Sunlight soap. And you shake like mad. It was before Palmolive when you're soaking in it. Maybe they just rusted and they were seen as so everyday that nobody kept them. I've never been able to find an original one.
Wow. It struck me when looking through your book that there is so much we should keep. I know there's a risk of hoarding, But there are beautiful everyday devices. There's that 1970s Welltron stereo with speakers. Yes. And they were trying to make tech more and more compact. And that's ended up with the iPhone. And God knows we'll have chips in our ears at some point.
But yes, we will.
You can see what they were trying to do.
I know. And they were so, I don't know, it played Chubby Checker really well.
Ashtrays. Now, they used to be in every workplace. And if I were interviewing you 30 years ago, I don't know if you ever smoked, but there would be an ashtray between the two of us and one of us would be puffing away.
Yes. And sometimes people had it behind their ears, in their hands, on the ashtray. The ashtrays now are really quite good for nuts. And if you go looking, they were often very exotic designs because we had this kidney-shaped design for tables and for ashtrays. And that came straight from the swimming pools of California. And it was thought of being very modernist. So, but down on the lower shelves of the remaining collectible shops, you'll find ashtrays. And the advertising to get women to smoke was just very beautiful. Like, now's the time for a Capstan, and people look most sophisticated lying back with your Capstan or your De Maurier cigarette.
De Maurier. Yes. Passport to international pleasure.
Yes. And you sat up the back of the plane and puffed your way to the poor people in front who had advanced asthma.
Puffed and coughed and wheezed your way across the sky. Are you going to sell this collection now? What will happen to it?
I'm not sure.
All right.
I'm opening the Butterfly House up on the Saturday of Labour weekend, 10 to 12 and 2 to 4, and tickets are available. And it's for the Mungawai Museum, $5 tickets, and it goes all to the Mungawai Museum.
It'll be a crowded batch that day.
It could be. And I've got some people playing 50s and 60s music on the lawn, so people can sort of loiter and think and have memory triggers and talk about early days.
Oh, I hope you have a lovely fine day.
Yes, so do I.
Paul Holmes, you know, the broadcaster, used to say that people who hanker for the good old days in New Zealand forget how dull they were. Mm-hmm. And yet there was that egalitarianism in society which has been tossed out the window along with the sunlight salt shakers. The book's called Mid-Century Living, and you describe many aspects of that living in it. Would you be happy to go back and live in that New Zealand now?
I don't know. Because we do partly. We're a great family for jigsaws, a great family for board games, great family for cards. So there's lots more conversation. There isn't so much, you know, crowding around the TV. I don't know. I suppose I've got fond memories of it because it was such a loving, simple time. And I don't know what simple means apart from you didn't have that much choice and you laughed a lot. Listening to the radio, that's for sure. Radio stayed constant.
Yeah, the radio hasn't changed much, except we've gone online as well as we had to. You're going around the country, you're going to lots of little places, talking to lots of people. Last question, really, what are the people talking to you about? What sort of reaction are you getting and comments are you getting about your book and about the collections you show them?
I've had one. I've got one. I remember that time. I love those things. Oh, let me touch it. Competitions we had up and down the street for our potluck dinners. I think they just loved that celebration of that time and the memories. And whether they would hanker back for it as they, you know, went off and had a latte, I don't know.
It's not just memories. You've also evoked that time and made it swirl around in people's minds, you know, with your own swizzle stick.
Yeah, I think what I'd really like to say is that I think the book is really important as a history, as a social history of that time. And just because the things are still only $10 or $20 or $25, apart from the special folk pieces, we must get over the idea because things don't cost much, they're not worth much. They're hugely valued to that period for us as New Zealanders for that period. And should be collected. $100 goes a long way in collecting our social history of that period.
If you had to run out of the batch with five things because, you know, heaven forbid there was an earthquake, what would you grab first?
My kids.
Apart from that?
I'd carry the big, I'd do the Crowdland lampshade. I'd do anything to do with Popeye Beavis, the folk person, Jane Brinkley. I certainly wouldn't take the Jim Beam bottles.
That'd stay and burn. Lovely to talk to you. Well done. It's been obviously long in gestation in this book, hasn't it?
It was. It took like 2 and a bit years. But that was just focusing on writing and being edited and writing again and finding the right way in which to celebrate this time and these articles and the people who designed and did and made them for us to reflect on.
Yeah, congratulations. It's a real tribute to them and those times.
Thank you, Jim.
The Eco, is it Eco or Esco, kiosk in Napier sells the soap shakers, says Alison Saville. Saw them there last week. Christine Ferniho.